9, 12, 10, 28, 2, 23.
This is Deep State Radio, coming to you direct from our super secret studio in the third sub-basement of the Ministry of Snark in Washington, D.C., and from other undisclosed locations across America and around the world.
Hello and welcome to the podcast. I'm David Rothkopf, your host. And as you know, every so often when a really important book comes out, we like to sit down with the author. We've got just such a book and a really special author here today. Jim Sciutto is CNN's chief national security analyst and anchor of CNN Newsroom. He reports and provides analysis across the network's programs and platforms on all aspects of U.S. national security, including foreign policy, the military, the intelligence community, and the State Department. And his book is The Return of Great Powers, Russia, China, and the Next World War. Welcome, Jim.
Thanks so much. It's really good to be on with you.
I thought this was an extremely well-done book, and it clearly is dealing with some really important issues. I'd like, you know, our audience is mostly foreign policy and national security oriented. And so I may get to some of the more domestically oriented components of the book a little bit later. But I'd like to go right to the core thesis, because you talk about being in Ukraine as the war started, or as this latest phase of the war started there in February of 22, and seeing this as a 1939 moment. That's an extremely loaded phrase, because obviously 1939 was the beginning of World War II. I'd like to dig a little bit deeper into that and ask you how you think this moment is analogous to that moment.
I understand it's a big historical comparison. And 1939, well, it brought about the deadliest war in human history, right? So I don't do it lightly. I'll tell you why I make that case. First of all, as I was in Ukraine in February 2022 at the start of, as you say, the full-scale invasion, because, of course, 8 years before, Russia had already come in smaller form. And I'd written prior, in 2019, I wrote a book called The Shadow War, about how Russia and China were attempting to undermine the U.S. just below the threshold of open conflict in a whole host of ways: quiet land grabs, cyber warfare, weaponizing space, stealing state secrets. So as I was in Ukraine in February 2022 and felt the first missile blasts on Ukrainian cities and saw the tanks coming across the border, Russia allocating the largest portion of its conventional military forces, all aligned against the largest country in Europe and starting the largest war we've seen since World War II, it struck me that this was a level up, right? An order of magnitude bigger and breaking through that threshold of open conflict. Yes, it was not against the US and NATO. However, it was the largest land war in Europe in 80 some odd years. And it represented a clean break with the relative peace we had enjoyed for the last 30-some-odd years, post-1989, 1991, where you have an aggressive, revanchist European leader willing to change the borders of Europe by force in grand scale. That's why it strikes me it's a moment like 1939. In addition to the fact, and by the way, I'm not saying Putin reaches Hitler's level, because of course Putin did not start the Holocaust, the worst murder in human history, although Putin has shown no reluctance to kill vast numbers of civilians in Ukraine. But in terms of the challenge it presents to Europe, because if a leader can do that, use military force to, in effect, absorb a country, a giant country of tens of millions of people, that sets a precedent. And we saw when we allowed that precedent to be set in 1939, and the appeasers made many of the same points that we're hearing today from today's appeasers. Well, just give him this peace and everything will be fine. The lesson we learned then is with leaders like that, they don't stop. I speak in the book at length with the Estonian Prime Minister, Kaja Kallas, who herself, her country Estonia, but she herself has experienced only a generation ago of living under the yoke of Soviet power, then Soviet power. They only gained their independence in 1991. And she likes to quote Churchill on Hitler about the crocodile, right? It's an appeaser is the one is the one who feeds a crocodile expecting that he or she will be the last meal. We learned in 1939, you cannot appease these people, leaders like this. And I think we're learning in 2022 and 2023 and 24 that the Putins of the world can't be appeased either. He took a piece of Georgia in 2008. He took a pieces of Ukraine in 2014. He's taken more pieces of Ukraine now. He calculates, I'm going to keep going until you stop me. And in addition to that, everyone I spoke to for this book, from Western Europe to Eastern Europe, all the way to Taiwan and Asia, says that China is watching Russia's experience with Ukraine because they might very well make the same calculation. If they can take that giant piece of land, I can, an independent and sovereign country, I can do the same to Taiwan. That's why I believe the scenarios, the moments in history, while not identical, they're at least analogous.
Yeah, they certainly are. And I'd like to break down the analogy a little bit further. First of all, it was very clever of you to have the President of the United States open the State of the Union with a reference to the same period, which I saw was directly promotional for your book. But you know, it does illustrate how fraught this moment is. Because, of course, when we look back at 1939, we look back at it in the context of a great war that took the toll that you described, but that we won. And we won because when it became a choice between the appeasers and those who would stand up to Hitler, we pushed aside the appeasers. Yeah. And there were appeasers in the UK, there were appeasers in France, and there were appeasers in the United States. And we ended up with Roosevelt and Churchill and not, you know, McMillan and Joe Kennedy, you know. So we ended up in a different place. But right now, as Biden illustrated or tried to make the point in his State of the Union, we are facing a choice in this moment between two sides in the United States that are presenting themselves as almost perfect analogy. Biden is, I'm with the Atlantic Alliance. We must stand up to Putin. We must stand up for democracy. We've got to do everything we can to stop the aggression so it doesn't extend further. And on the other hand, you have a candidate for the Republican Party who just met with Viktor Orban, and Viktor Orban came out of the meeting and said he doesn't want to spend another penny on Ukraine. The reason he'll end the war, you know, the day after, you know, is that he will go to Putin and work out a deal with him. And of course, that means literally appeasement. And so here we are, you know, playing out the domestic analogy of what was going on in these countries then. Am I drawing that too starkly? Are there differences between these two situations?
The old saying, history doesn't repeat itself, but it rhymes. If you look back to the late 30s and 40, 41, the statements of the America First crowd then and today are almost identical to a word, right? America First, the phrase. They had similar conspiracy theories then. At the time, there was this allegation that Pearl Harbor was a conspiracy by FDR and others to get the U.S. into the war, not dissimilar from what you hear from some on the right in this country today about, well, Ukraine is corrupt and we tempted Russia into war and it's the military-industrial complex wants to sell. Whatever, you know, choose your flavor of conspiracy theory. But so many of the arguments for appeasement from 1939 to 2024 are quite similar, you know, down to the more general point. That's not our war, right? That's far enough away. We don't want to get involved in it. Better to spend this money at home, etc. And I believe, and I make the case in the book, and by the way, from talking to folks much closer to the conflict than you and me, right? People in Ukraine, people in the Baltics, people in Taiwan. I make the argument in the book that, you know, this very much is about our security. It's not just goodwill to protect the sovereign nations of Ukraine and what is not an independent state of Taiwan, but is certainly sovereign in the way it operates. It's not just goodwill. It's in our interests to not allow force as the fundamental weapon and tool of geopolitics to stand in such raw form, because you and I have benefited from the relative peace of the decades since World War II. We can travel, work, study, do business in countries of Eastern Europe that 30 years ago we couldn't. We can travel through Asia in those ways that we couldn't. Our kids could do semesters abroad in these countries, and a great deal of our economic growth, and by the way, their economic growth, Europe's and Asia's and China's, is the result of that relative peace, open sea lanes, trade, etc. That helps us too. And then, beyond the economic and personal benefit, when you add in the enormous capabilities of today's weapons that didn't exist back in World War II or till very late in World War II, nuclear weapons, cyber weapons, space weapons, that if you do end up in a conflict like this, we will very much feel it at home. So while it may seem like a distant conflict, or may seem that this is only geopolitical charity on the part of the U.S. to stand in the way of a Putin or Xi, it actually is very much in our interest to do so, much as I think you could say it was in 1941.
Yeah, no question about it. And of course, one question that is begged by the title of your book is, you know, when you say the return of the great powers, they never actually went away. Yeah. We looked at them somewhat differently. And I think, you know, we were seduced, and I was in the Clinton administration, but we were seduced by the post-Cold War illusion. Yeah. And you make reference to that too, of, you know, of the hyperpower, one superpower world, the United States, where there were no other challenges, history was over. But actually throughout that period, China was growing, and growing like no country had ever grown in the history of the world, 40 years, 6%+ growth, and so forth. I'd just like to get your explanation of this notion that somehow great powers are more important today than they were 20 years ago.
Well, I reference in here, you know, of course, we all remember the moment, and I don't want to beat him up too much, but Francis Fukuyama's End of History, right? We all succumb to that, and with hope, and understandable hope. I speak to Jens Stoltenberg in the book at length, the NATO Secretary General, and he talks about, you know, growing up in the midst of a very dangerous Cold War and fears of another nuclear conflict, and when that fever seemed to break in 89, 91, and the sense that all was peaceful and liberal democracy had won over, of course we would celebrate that. The trouble is, as you say, China was growing. And by the way, not just economically, it was very much growing its military and its ambitions, and actually speaking very publicly about what its ambitions were in terms of the United States to become, if not a superior power, at least an equal power. And Russia was not getting rid of its nuclear weapons, limiting them, yes, but no, it was advancing its submarine forces to be capable as a great power. So I suppose we had hope. Some of that hope was undue. It's understandable, perhaps, given what we went through. But we, and when I say we, both administrations, right, Americans and Europeans, were mirroring. We were imagining that Russia and China wanted what we want. And the truth is they didn't. They see the global system as to our advantage and not theirs. And now we're experiencing, right, what they're willing to do to change that global system, not just to weaken us, but to bring it down. And we, listen, we writ large share responsibility for not seeing the light earlier.
So let's break it down a little bit further. I think an argument can be made that Russia and China are extremely different. And I'll get to China in a moment. But Russia economically is not a great power.
Right.
Russia politically is not a great power. Russia is a great power because it has the largest nuclear weapons stockpile on Earth. And it's a significant power because it has a lot of oil and gas. It has some resources that provide some leverage. But Russia, unlike China, is a declining power by most metrics. Demographics, aging society, not replacing, a lot of people leaving, brain drain, inability to compete, and so forth. And of course, we have seen Ukraine, with a modicum of support from the West, kick Russia's ass on the battlefield. So this was the vaunted, at the beginning of this period of the war, where the, you know, your sort of focus of the book begins, Russia was the second best military in the world.
Yeah.
They're not that. We know they're not that now, right? Even if political fecklessness in the United States gives them a second chance, we know that they're not that. How do you make the case beyond nuclear weapons that Russia is actually a great power?
Well, it's interesting, and I agree with you that you have a declining power and a rising power. Declining power in Russia, rising power in China. The trouble is, each can be dangerous in its own way, right? Russia is a declining power. It sees its best way to exercise or try to resurrect its position as, you know, the good old days of the Soviet Union, in Putin's view, via military means, via disruption, via invasion, via stirring the pot in other places. I have a section in the book about how Russia loves to see the war in Israel and Gaza. And that's one reason why Russia sent a surface-to-air missile system to Hezbollah in the midst of this war, because it's a good way to occupy the U.S., cause some trouble over there. So, yes, Russia, weak economically. It is that, as McCain famously said, the gas station masquerading as a nation. But it still maintains the largest nuclear arsenal in the world. It is, and we've had some reporting on this, as have others, it's looking for ways that it can use that nuclear arsenal in new ways, including as weapons in space. I have a long section in the book about just how close Russia came to using a tactical nuclear weapon in Ukraine in 2022. So even as it is declining in many ways, it is still extremely dangerous and uniquely dangerous as that kind of declining power that almost with an inferiority complex, right, wants to still say, hey, I can still make trouble around the world and challenge you. Whereas China, listen, it's a juggernaut of an economy and also has this other complication, which I talk about, enormous economic ties with the U.S. too, right? I mean, codependency might be too strong a term, but our interests economically certainly are very much intertwined.
Yeah, I don't think it's too strong a term at all. I do think one area where Russia has some strength, paradoxically enough, given the failure of almost every idea that's come out of Russia of significance since, 1918, is that Putin is leading a global ethno-nationalist authoritarian movement that includes Trump, Netanyahu, Modi. It included Bolsonaro. It includes Orban. It included, you know, it includes Le Pen. It includes other people. And for some reason, at this moment in our history, that anti-globalist view that seeks another and seeks to condemn and scapegoat that other is extremely popular. And frankly, it was one of the reasons I like the structure of your book compared to some others that are coming out on similar topics at the moment, is that you talk about this as a potential trigger for the next war and not as the beginning of a new Cold War. because I think the Cold War analogy doesn't work, and I'll get to that in a second. But I just was wondering how you might address this notion that somehow Vladimir Putin, a terrible leader at almost everything, has managed to capture the zeitgeist of this big movement.
Well, you're absolutely right. There's a cultural element to it. You know, some on the right in our own country see a brother in arms here in the culture wars, anti-gay, you know, anti-woke, you know, and Putin echoes some of the, I mean, their words echo each other again, you know, they almost repeat each other, their phrases and their arguments. So you have that side of it. And it just strikes me how deeply ignorant it is, you know, when to see Tucker Carlson in one Moscow grocery store, somehow therefore claiming that, well, Russia might have it right, ignoring around him the corruption, the violence of the system, how anyone who challenges Putin, whether he's a dissident, Navalny, or a journalist or others, dies or falls off balconies or goes to penal colonies where they suffer and die. The ignorance at the root of it is just mind-boggling. And it is reflected very much in the comments and beliefs of the man at the top, Donald Trump. I have long interview in the book, interviews with former senior Trump officials, John Kelly among them, who recounts Donald Trump's frequent praise for Adolf Hitler. Again, based, first of all, offensive in its own right and appalling, but also based on a fundamental misunderstanding of the man. Kelly talks about how, well, you know, Hitler did some good things, quote unquote. He rebuilt the economy. Kelly had to remind him, well, he rebuilt the German economy and then turned it on Europe. And he says, well, Hitler's generals were loyal to him. And John Kelly has to say to him, Hitler's generals tried to kill him. You know, they just don't know and have no interest in knowing the true nature of these people, whether it's Hitler or Putin. And by the way, as I recount in the book, speaking not just to Kelly, but John Bolton and others, Trump somehow imagines that purely by force of his personality and this affinity he feels for the Putins and Xis and Kims of the world, he can create an accommodation, a balance, which also fundamentally misunderstands what Putin, Xi, Kim, what they want. They want to weaken the U.S. They want to break down the system we depend on. Trump just doesn't see it, won't see it, and as president would turn a 180 on how the U.S. approaches the world.
Yeah, and I think, you know, the most striking thing about the revelation, and it's not even quite a revelation, but the underscoring of Trump's admiration for Hitler is the utter silence from the members of his party in condemning it. The utter silence and their you know, condemnations of his embrace of Orban or Putin, or they're actually falling along. And so that's, you know, that's one of the things that suggests that this 1939 moment could go the other way. We don't know which way it's going to go in terms of American politics. And we could have the Charles Lindbergh, Joe Kennedy America that Adolf Hitler was counting on. Now, having said that, let's shift a bit to the China side of this thing. Because I do think it's different in a number of other respects. One difference is China's rising power. Or you could characterize it as a recovering power. China was the largest economy in the world until 1835.
That's fell behind. Their view is regaining their rightful place at the top.
And you know, they went through the Industrial Revolution, and now we're at the other side of it, and they've sort of regained their ground. But the Chinese economy is deeply integrated with our economy. There's 70,000 U.S. businesses in China. We share a lot. It's why I personally reject the new Cold War analogy, because Cold War was a zero-sum game. If Russia lost, if Soviet Union lost, we gained. Mm. If China's economy falters, we're in trouble. Mm. If China and we can't get along on a bunch of issues, we can't solve those issues, whether it's climate or transmigration or pandemics. But the question is, does China pose a challenge that could lead to that next war? And we've had people say that Graham Allison wrote the Thucydides Trap, and we often cite Taiwan. Yeah. But other than Taiwan, China has not really shown it, some sandbars in the South China Sea, China has not really shown an expansionist desire. And I'm not being an apologist for China here, but there's a strong distinction I draw between Russia, which wants to blow up the international system mm-hmm. because it can't win in the international system, and China, which wants to alter the international system but preserve it, because China wants order. China wants a world in which it can predictably grow. Do you think that's also an accurate distinction? And if so, do you see China as a lesser or different kind of threat?
If you're tired of hearing ads, you can support the show by becoming a member. This week, listeners of the DSR Network shows can receive 25% off the membership price. In addition to an ad-free listening experience, members receive bonus content for virtually all of our shows via our private member feed, enhanced show notes for selected podcasts, an invitation to join the DSR Slack community, and early access to select podcasts. Visit thedsrnetwork.com/buy and enter code DSRNetwork, one word, to receive 25% off. That's thedsrnetwork.com/buy and code DSRNetwork. This offer is limited and will expire on Saturday, March 16th, so act now. And thank you very much for your support.
Well, I agree with the different desires as relates to the international rules-based order, right? Russia wants to tear it down. China wants to replace it with something more in their interests, and with China at the top, really. Bill Burns talks about this distinction in the book. He talks about Putin being the guy who wants to bring the temple down, right? But China wants to replace it in its own image. I will say, though, that China is and has proven to be expansionist, just slowly, more subtle may not be the word, because yes, they were just rocks in the South China Sea, but claimed by six nations with enormous energy reserves under them. And though it promised never to militarize those manufactured islands in the South China Sea, a promise accepted by U.S. presidents, including President Obama, it has. Those are unsinkable aircraft carriers, as the military calls them now, in the South China Sea, with airstrips and missile launchers and bombers and fighters and so on. So they do it just a little bit more gradually, perhaps. And they, you know, it's interesting. When I did a stint, as you know, in diplomacy as chief of staff to the U.S. ambassador to China. This was 2011 to 2013, 10 years ago, just over. And I remember at the time, there was a lot of skepticism among my colleagues in State Department about what China wanted to do with its Navy. At the time, they said they have no interest in a blue water Navy. This aircraft carrier that they bought from Ukraine, interestingly, it's really just an ego piece. We've seen in the 10 years since then, no, China's Navy is bigger than ours. It has established outposts as far afield as Sri Lanka. It has the desire to push out through the island chains as they see the world, Taiwan included in there. They do want a presence. Is it as far afield as America's? Maybe not. Certainly not for now. But it's certainly more aggressive and expansionist than we understood them to be just a few years ago.
Yeah, no question. They've opened a naval base in Djibouti. They're talking about opening a naval base in Pakistan. That would have them on either side of the entrance to the Persian Gulf. They depend on the Persian Gulf. I guess the distinction is the Chinese and the Americans both realize they need each other to some degree.
True.
The Chinese and the U.S. and the Russians do not.
Yeah. Right? And that's why you've seen this, you know, it may not be lasting, but this temporary detente between the U.S. and China in recent months. I heard Bill Burns testifying about this in the threats briefing before the Senate, saying that, actually it was Avril Haines, saying that for now, China calculates it cannot get in a big economic fight with the U.S. because they have economic headwinds at home, not good for political stability, etc. Trouble is, the U.S. view remains that when strategic issues are top in their minds, they will suffer through those economic consequences. And they view things like Taiwan as a strategic interest. Now, Xi hasn't pulled the trigger yet, but he is certainly watching events in Ukraine for a sense of what would happen if he were to pull the trigger, and how long and how aggressively the U.S. and the West and Taiwan's allies would react.
Well, yeah. I mean, Xi also knows that with regard to Taiwan, that if you, you know, engage in a war with Taiwan and destroy the chip production capacity of Taiwan, that you send the world into a global depression. That's not a good thing for them. The biggest trading partner with Fujian province is Taiwan. They're very integrated economies. That's a problem for them. And the other slight difference there, and in this regard, perhaps it's more analogous to Russia's views of Ukraine, although I think less supportable, is they still think Taiwan's part of China, and they think it's always been part of China, and the U.S., you know, has signed on to a one China policy a long time ago. And they sort of think, well, we're going to carry that forward. You're absolutely right. And I think the book makes an extremely good case that the situation with China is precarious. The situation with Russia is precarious. The refocus away from the forever wars in the Middle East made a lot of sense because these other issues are important. And our alliances are important. I mean, it's another area where there are big distinctions, right? Tom Donilon, the former national security advisor, used to always say, you know, our alliances are our sort of secret sauce. They're the thing that makes America different from every other country. And you've seen us build them in the Pacific with AUKUS and Quad and the new U.S., South Korea, Japan agreement and so forth. And with the expansion of NATO. And you also have, you know, another distinction, which is that Trump is kind of anti-alliance. He thinks alliances are just for the other. We don't benefit from them. And it seems to me that as a last question here, we came out of that 1939 war, and we said the way we avoid it in the future is we build an international system. We built the UN system, we built NATO, we built a post-Cold War order that held. I guess the real question now is, will it hold, or will we pull the rug out from under it? And I think in your book you have Bolton talking about, you know, Trump's desire to pull out of NATO. To me, that strikes me as one of the great threats, because that is, you know, an invitation wrapped in a ribbon to people like Vladimir Putin. Do you agree?
I do. And listen, it as I said earlier, the choice in November for American voters is enormous, domestically certainly, but in terms of the U.S. position in the world, because you have two diametrically opposed views in Biden and Trump. And Trump, again, based on the analysis of his own former senior advisors, will make enormous changes. He will either pull out of or neuter NATO. He has no interest in the, or less interest certainly, in U.S. security agreements with South Korea, with Japan. He just doesn't see them in his interest. And you know, it always strikes me, and again, in this year's Oscars, our movies are still about the U.S. standing up in World War II. Every year, we have another movie about that moment. We were tested. We stood up. We're still congratulating ourselves about that. While today, we're being tested again, and we don't know the outcome. We don't know if we will repeat the mistakes of the appeasers. And a lot will come down to the decision between who runs the country. And listen, you know, folks have asked me, well, do you want to see the U.S. go to war with Russia over Ukraine, or go to war with China over Taiwan? And I always tell them, I have 15 and 13-year-old boys. You know, they would be draft age in a minute. I don't want them to die there any more than any other mother or father or serves there. I have no appetite for it. But I do believe, and I think history teaches us this, that if you let crimes like this stand, right? If you show that you are willing to cede on your basic, your most basic principles that not only are your values, but have helped keep the peace for decades, that the Xis and Putins of the world, like Hitler, will take that as an invitation. And the question is, if we appease again, what will the world look like? How long will the peace last? And I'm not convinced the peace will last that long.
It is an extraordinarily well put point, and it is the core point. We in the United States will often frame the upcoming election as a red-blue choice, or as a choice between a democracy and authoritarianism here. It's a choice for the world, because this past 80-year period has been defined by a certain kind of U.S. leadership. And your analogy to 1939 is exactly the right analogy between those who would stand up to aggressors and to dictators, and those who would appease them. And we're being asked to make the choice again. And your book helps them address that choice. And I think it frames it exactly right. And that's why The Return of Great Powers by Jim Sciutto is such a important book, why I encourage our extremely nerdy audience of tens of thousands of foreign policy and national security specialists out there to get the book and to read it. Congratulations, Jim. Thanks for joining us here. We will also, of course, continue to watch you for your excellent work and coverage on CNN.
Thank you for having me, David. I'm just as nerdy on all these issues, so it's nice to be among my own, and I do appreciate you taking the time with me.
We nerds have got to stick together. That's the premise of the entire DSR network. Anyway, thank you, Jim. Thank you, everybody, for listening. We'll be back again with more on just these topics and their related subjects each and every day of the week. We're now up to, I think, 17 or 18 podcasts each week. So join us again then. Until then, bye-bye.